everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for joining us for this case. This is one I've been wanting to cover since we started the podcast. And I brought it up before during the Alexis Dillard case we covered in episode 35, because the cases remind me of each other. So we're finally getting to it. There was an independent film or documentary about this case that was created years ago by a Kansas City filmmaker named Brian Rose, which provided a lot of extra information. So I wanted to call that out. All right, let's get into today's case. Jesse Ross was 19 years old at the time of his disappearance in 2006. Jesse grew up in Raytown, Missouri, a suburb of Kansas City, with his brother and parents, Don and Donna. Jesse was a bit of a wild child, and I learned right away that he always had a big personality. He was outgoing, funny. Essentially, if he was in the room, you'd know it. But he also had a softer side. His parents characterized him as having a big heart. After Jesse graduated high school in 2005, he enrolled in the University of Missouri, Kansas City, or UMKC, where he majored in communications and pursued a minor in political science. Jesse wanted to go to the University of Kansas, where Sean and I graduated from, but his parents told him it would be too expensive since they lived in Missouri and would have to pay out-of-state tuition. Now, I know I said he grew up in Raytown and he graduated from high school in Raytown, but his family moved to Belton, Missouri at some point, which is farther south than where they were before. Jesse moved along with them and he stayed at home for his freshman year of college and into his sophomore year. So he had about a 25-minute commute from his parents' home to the UMKC campus. And before his disappearance, his parents were fixing up his bedroom in the basement of their home, and Jesse was pretty excited about this. While Jesse was a student, he landed an internship with the popular local radio station 95.7 The Vibe. I'm sure our Kansas City listeners remember 95.7. And I say remember because the station switched to 107.3 last year. Jesse had a special segment on the Shorty and the Boys morning show where he would go to various mystery locations in Kansas City and give hints about where he was. Listeners would then call in to guess the location of Opie. Opie Cunningham was his on-air name. They thought Jesse looked like a young Ron Howard, so they combined two of Ron's characters' names, Opie Taylor from The Andy Griffith Show and Richie Cunningham from Happy Days, to get Opie Cunningham. The segment was called Where's Opie?
It's kind of eerie that he had this segment on 95.7 where he would go to random places and have callers try to find where he was, and then he actually ended up disappearing.
Oh, I know. I had the same thought. It's definitely eerie. Feels a little foreboding. Shortly before his disappearance, Jesse was offered a paid position with 95.7 that would begin early in 2007, and he was looking forward to this opportunity. Jesse also created music. He would mix music on CDs and share them with people. He was the manager of a local rock band called A Dead Giveaway, and he had recently pledged the Lambda Chi Alpha fraternity. Saturday, November 18th, 2006, was an exciting time for Jesse. His dad, Don, dropped him off at UMKC, and Jesse, along with 13 of his classmates, were headed to Chicago, Illinois, in a van where they would attend an American Model or MOC United Nations conference for 4 days. About 1,200 students across various universities in the United States participated in this conference, and Jesse had attended the year before in 2005, so he was familiar with it. The students who attend simulate UN committees, hence the model part of the name, but it's also a good way for students to learn more about the United Nations and international relations as a whole. That year, 2006, Jesse was a part of a delegation that represented the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Jesse was passionate about politics, so this convention was a good opportunity for him. The first few days of the conference involved quite a few presentations, meetings, and general sightseeing. And by the third day of the conference, Monday, November 20th, the participants had a few hours in the afternoon to spend how they wanted. So Jesse and a couple of others explored Chicago and went to a few stores and restaurants before returning that evening for scheduled meetings. Jesse called his mom that day and told her he was having a great time and that he would see her soon since the conference was nearing its end. That night, there was a dance organized for all the students at the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Chicago, where all of the meetings and events had been held over the past several days. Alcohol was not permitted at the event. As you can imagine, a lot of the students were not of legal drinking age, but that didn't stop them. Students were known to drink at this event in the past. The UMKC chaperone, who was a new professor named Derek, was warned before he went, because it was his first time attending, that the year before, in 2005, a young woman drank so much that she wasn't able to get back into her hotel room and she ended up sleeping in the hallway of her hotel alone. The UMKC students told Derek they didn't want to go to the dance, mainly because they were staying at a different hotel. Jesse and the other UMKC students were staying in, it was another Sheraton hotel called the Four Points Sheraton, and it was less than half a mile away from the hotel where much of the conference was held. So Derek was under the impression that they were not going to the dance and that they were going back to their hotel. So Derek went out for a bite to eat, but the students, including Jesse, decided to go to the dance. Derek would later say that had he known they attended the dance, he would have been there. Jesse and the others were drinking at hotel room parties before and after the dance, although no one seemed to have a solid grasp on Jesse's alcohol consumption or his level of intoxication. Some people thought he was pretty drunk, while others said he was not. One person said they even had to help him walk at one point, and another person said he was walking with no issue. So the statements are contradictory when it comes to how inebriated Jesse was. Of course, people saw him at various points over the course of that night, so that could explain some of the variation, but memories also could have been blurred since it seemed as though everyone was drinking that night.
So I think people, even if they were maybe a little buzzed or tipsy or maybe even drunk, they would remember Jesse if he was stumbling around, if he was acting drunk, more than they would if he wasn't acting like that.
Yes, I think you'd be more likely to forget if he weren't acting that drunk rather than if he seemed super drunk. So the people, I guess I put a little more weight in the people who remember Jesse being pretty drunk that night. But again, we're talking about various points over the night, so it's hard to say. Maybe he got pretty drunk and then kind of sobered up a little bit toward the end of the night. So Jesse partied with other students at his hotel before the dance. He then went to the dance for a little bit, and then Jesse attended a party at the conference hotel on the 8th floor where more drinking took place.
So are these parties, you say parties, are these just happening in different students' hotel rooms?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, they're all just joining up in one person's hotel room or, okay, you know, multiple people's hotel room and drinking together. Suddenly, around 2 or 2:30 a.m., Jesse and somewhere between 30 and 50 other attendees who were a part of the security council were called to an emergency meeting simulation in one of the ballrooms in the Sheraton Hotel that was to last for several hours. The aim was to ensure everyone is prepared for a crisis, recognizing that it could strike at any time, day or night, in the real world. So this security council session was to last through the night. Jesse shared a hotel room with his longtime friend and classmate, Ralph, who was also called to the crisis simulation. And Ralph and Jesse went to the same high school, so they'd been friends for quite a while. Around 2:50 a.m., Jesse walked up to Ralph, said something to him that Ralph didn't catch, and Jesse left the room through the doors of the meeting room. It's unfortunate that we don't know what Jesse said to Ralph. And I thought about this a lot, but reality is he may have said something as simple as, hey, I'm heading out for a break. When he walked out, he passed another student who recalled Jesse having red eyes and slurred speech. And Jesse said he was going to step away for a break just to get some fresh air. So this may be what he also said to Ralph. But of course, no one knows because Ralph couldn't hear what Jesse said. And this young man who saw him as he stepped out of the meeting room was the last person to have contact with him that we know of. Ralph returned to their shared hotel room around 4 a.m. He didn't turn the lights on so as not to wake Jesse. And as he navigated through the darkness, he glanced at Jesse's bed and noticed what he believed to be Jesse lying there. When Ralph woke up the next day, he realized that Jesse was not in the room and had not been there the night before because his bed looked exactly as it did when Ralph went to bed. Reportedly, there was a pile of clothes on Jesse's bed that Ralph mistook as Jesse in the darkness. It's a little strange to mistake clothes for a person, but I think if you couple the darkness with how tired he must have been, it doesn't seem that strange at all. I can imagine he was eager to just get to sleep at that point. After Ralph realized Jesse was nowhere to be found, but his stuff, meaning his luggage and clothes, were still in the room, he reported this to the UMKC chaperone named Derek. Derek looked around the room as well and noticed there was an empty gallon jug of vodka in the room. Jesse, Ralph, and others had been kind of sipping on that vodka over the course of their time in Chicago. It's not that Jesse just drank this by himself. All that was missing from Jesse's room was the outfit he was last seen in, his cell phone, wallet, you know, all items that would have been on his person, and their calls to Jesse went directly to his voicemail. Derek decided to gather and pack Jesse's belongings for him with Ralph's assistance since they needed to check out of the hotel. They were operating under the assumption that they would find Jesse, and the considerate thing to do would be to put his stuff together. Ralph told some of the other students that he couldn't find Jesse. They began asking around, and the kind of initial idea was that maybe Jesse slept in another room that night. But as the day went on, that became an unlikely reality. As Derek, Ralph, and a few others were searching for Jesse, many students were leaving Chicago to return home since they had reached the end of the conference, and many students went to their hometowns rather than where the school is located for those who went to school away from their hometown because Thanksgiving was nearing. Derek notified hotel security about the situation around 1 p.m.
So at this point, it's been a while since anyone has seen Jesse, and I'm sure everyone's worried about him. Has anyone considered filing a police report for a missing person?
Yes. So that was their next move. That afternoon, around 4 p.m., they started getting really worried. Can't find Jesse, right? And Derek decided to go to the nearest Chicago police station and report him as a missing person. He also called Jesse's parents to inform them of the situation. Don and Donna were surprised and they felt a bit helpless because they were in Kansas City while Jesse vanished from Chicago, which is about an 8-hour drive away. It's a quick flight, but you can't just hop on a flight on a moment's notice. Then there was a major blizzard, so Jesse's parents couldn't make it to Chicago until December 10th, a few weeks after Jesse vanished. So Derek informed Jesse's parents, and then later that day, he directed the remaining UMKC students to go home, and he stayed in Chicago to search for Jesse. The Chicago police seemed to take Jesse's disappearance seriously from the outset, and that's good. I feel like I shouldn't have to note that, but I can see how this could have been a case where it wasn't taken seriously early on. They could have just said, oh, he's an adult. You know, he ran off to do whatever, but they didn't do that. And I think that was partially because Jesse was visiting Chicago. He was not a resident there, but there were other factors that played into it.
Yeah, I mean, technically, he was an adult, and I'm sure they were treating this case as such. But, you know, on the other hand, he's still a teenager, right? He's 19. So I'm sure they gave this case a little more focus because he was still a teenager and a student that was just visiting the city.
Right, exactly. I think it was kind of all of those factors that combined that caused them to take it so seriously so early on. The police looked for digital evidence. They wanted to retrace Jesse's steps. They reviewed video footage from Jesse's hotel, the hotel where the conference was held, and everywhere in between, and it helped piece the night together a bit more. They spotted Jesse leaving the hotel where he was staying at 12:43 a.m. Remember, this is the night leading up to his disappearance, and he'd been drinking with other students at that hotel, and that group decided to head to the conference hotel for the dance. Then he's captured at the entrance of the Sheridan Hotel where the conference was held at 1:09 a.m. Jesse made the walk alone, but it was a 26-minute difference between when he was seen leaving and arriving, which is interesting because it should have only taken 10 to 15 minutes to make the walk. No one knows why it took 26 minutes.
Maybe since he was apparently pretty drunk that he could have been walking a little slower or stumbling around, and it could have taken him way longer than expected for that distance of a walk.
Right. I think that's a strong possibility here. And I don't really know why he and the other people in the group kind of split up on their walk. But the reason I point that out is because it's not like we have his friends who can say, oh, you know, Jesse was lagging behind or anything like that. He just seemed to kind of walk by himself. Jesse was spotted on camera for a final time around 2:50 a.m. inside the hotel after he whispered something to Ralph and left the ballroom where the crisis simulation meeting was held. The police reported that Jesse did not appear that intoxicated from the footage, and he was walking as if nothing was wrong while holding a Gatorade bottle or some sort of plastic energy drink bottle. I presume they mean he did not seem overly intoxicated because you can be drunk and still walk as you normally do. Either way, it's important to understand that Jesse did not appear super intoxicated. He was not in a hurry and he was alone when he left the room. It's often reported that the hotel exits had cameras except for one exit on the south side of the building. This side would take you right out to the Chicago River, onto the Esplanade, and in the opposite direction of Jesse's hotel. So many surmised that was the exit Jesse used since he was not captured on camera leaving the hotel. But there was actually another exit that didn't have cameras. When Jesse walked out of the meeting room, he could have walked down the corridor to more of a service type door, and that would lead you to a staircase that takes you down to where the valet parking is at the front of the hotel facing north, so the opposite side of the river. Ralph indicated that they had used that door several times before when leaving that room, and Ralph didn't even know about it until Jesse showed him. Those who attended the conference found it more likely he would have used this exit than the south side one, because the south side one was more complicated to get to from the room where the emergency meeting was held, and Jesse wasn't known to use that exit. And if Jesse walked out near the valet parking, there were external cameras, but they were angled in such a way, and it was so dark, that he wouldn't have been captured if he walked straight out. There weren't many external cameras that faced the river, and the police couldn't find him on any other cameras that night. There were plenty of businesses and cameras along the route from the conference hotel and the hotel he was staying at. So Jesse wanted to go back to his hotel, or at least head in that direction. He managed to do it in such a way that he wasn't captured on camera. We will share the last image of Jesse on our Instagram, Key to the Case podcast. But it's haunting to see, mostly because we know something horrible, whatever it may be, likely happened to him shortly after he was seen on that camera. The police set up search teams, and there was a focus on the area near the hotel where the conference was held and the areas surrounding that hotel and Jesse's hotel. Searchers dug through garbage bins and scoured alleyways, Helicopters and cadaver dogs were used, but they never came upon a single sign of Jesse. The river was a major focus too, just because of its proximity to the hotel. There is a possibility that Jesse went over the railing into the river. I thought I knew this case pretty well before researching it from reading about it or listening to coverage of it, but I did not realize what I'm about to share. And I believe the information is important to understand in the context of this case. The Chicago police said sometimes people experience accidents like this, with the Kansas City Star reporting in 2007 that bodies turn up all the time in the Chicago River. And all the time is certainly a hyperbole. It's not as though every day bodies are turning up in the Chicago River, but there are instances where people die by suicide by entering the river, or less frequently, they accidentally fall in. And the police said that the people are always found 5 to 10 feet from where they enter the water. They aren't traveling far or being swept away. And they figured with the water temperature and conditions at the time of Jesse's disappearance that if Jesse fell into the river and drowned, his body would have sunk to the bottom and not moved much. The police department's marine water unit was brought in for a thorough underwater search. This included the use of sonar equipment and divers.
So at the time when Jesse disappeared, do you know how deep that river was?
About 20 feet. That depth does not feel insurmountable when it comes to searching, but it is 156 miles or 251 kilometers long. Anytime something of interest was identified when they were using the sonar equipment, a diver was promptly sent down to investigate. According to reporting from the Washington Diplomat, Mike Roth, a detective with the Chicago Police, said about the river, quote, "The river is a nasty environment. There are cars in there, debris, branches, you name it. It used to be a dumping ground. It's dark and murky, and there are all kinds of chemicals. Some bodies come up to the surface within a day, but others come up months later. There's no rule," end quote. Now, the Chicago River does connect with Lake Michigan, but as I'm sure our Chicago listeners know, there is a lock system or gate in place between the river and the lake. The primary purpose of the lock system is flood control. It helps manage water levels, but also to facilitate the passage of boats between the Chicago River and Lake Michigan. Notably, the flow has been engineered so that the lake flows into the river rather than the other way around. So the current travels away from the lake. I think it's important to note this because Lake Michigan is enormous. And if Jesse entered Lake Michigan, his body would be much harder to recover. Knowing that the lock system is in place greatly reduces the possibility that he entered Lake Michigan because he couldn't have slipped through the gate. If he entered Lake Michigan, it would have been when the gate was open. The police say that it was open for vessel travel for about an hour at 7:30 a.m., so about 5 hours after Jesse vanished. But the lock maintenance engineer for the Chicago Harbor Lock explained that it's very unlikely Jesse entered Lake Michigan because of the flow of the river. Again, it flows away from the lake. Plus, the distance from Lake Michigan and the Conference Hotel is about half a mile. That would be a great distance for Jesse to travel against the flow or to be caught under a vessel and transported that way. So I think it's good to share the input from the lock engineer because he's going to know best, right? This is his specialty. All that to say, despite numerous searches, including going completely upriver, the police consistently came up empty.
Yeah, I just have no idea why they were searching upstream of the river from where they're predicting he entered. You know, based on the proximity of his hotel and where he potentially would have entered the river, he's not going to float upstream through the Chicago River and enter Lake Michigan.
So maybe I didn't clarify this well enough, but when I was saying they searched upriver, I meant like the northern part of the river, because the Chicago River has kind of the central part that's in the middle of the city, and then it goes north and south. So they went, when I say upriver, they went downstream, but it's considered upriver because they're going north. So the area around where the hotel was is kind of in that central part. That whole area was surged. And then my point was they went up from there because if a body is going to travel, that would likely be the way it would.
Yeah, so I suppose I misunderstood. So they're not focusing efforts upstream of the river. They're focusing efforts up river, which is in relation to north of the downstream part of the main part of the river, right? I guess, right?
So I guess the overarching point here is that if Jesse entered the river, and this ties back to what I was saying about Lake Michigan and the lock system that's in place, he's likely still in the river today. I didn't see much evidence to support that he could have entered Lake Michigan. And I just think that's important because it's such a larger body of water to search. There was a railing or iron security barrier along the river, and it's about 4 feet tall. So if Jesse fell into the river, I think he would have had to have been leaning over the railing, possibly vomiting or even going to the bathroom or even pushed in. It's not as though you could walk along this and just topple over out of nowhere. And I've been to Chicago a few times to visit my close friends who live there. And Sean and I went there earlier this year in March. And we stayed very close to the hotel where the conference was held.
Yeah, you asked me, and I think you're in process of researching this case. Hey, could you inadvertently fall over this railing?
I did ask you that, yes.
My thought was, I don't think so.
Yeah, when you're standing by the railing, it seems hard to believe that you could just topple over. Right. It's not impossible, right? It's not like this goes over your head or something, but it is hard to imagine that happening.
I mean, yeah, definitely based on, it would be based on height. Admittedly, I'm on the shorter side. I'm about 5'9". If someone was taller than me, I think it would be way easier for them to fall over the railing in some capacity, right?
Yeah, different centers of gravity.
Yes.
And Jesse was about 5'10". So I don't know if that changes your thoughts at all.
No, I think we're pretty equivalent in height. I would have found it hard to just accidentally fall over the railing. I think I would have had to been really leaning over hard or pushed over in order to fall over that railing.
Yeah. And what's also concerning and what I noticed when we were there is that it would be difficult to pull yourself out of the river if you fell in. There aren't a lot of ledges you could grab onto or anything to really like help yourself up once you're in the water. And if you fell in with the water temperatures being as cold as they were, I don't know the exact temperature of the water when Jesse vanished, but the temperature outside was in the low to mid 30s Fahrenheit or roughly 0 degrees Celsius. Unfortunately, based on this and statements from police, if Jesse entered the river, the probability of him surviving would have been fairly low. Further investigation, including the review of Jesse's financial transactions and his cell phone records, showed that all activity stopped after Jesse left the ballroom. There were no further transactions on his credit or debit cards, and his cell phone died shortly after he left the ballroom. The last active ping from his phone was from around 3 or 3:30 a.m., somewhere in that general area of Chicago. When they reviewed his activity before his disappearance, nothing suspicious came up. There were no large withdrawals, no mysterious phone calls or texts. None of his activities deviated from what was normal for him.
So were any of Jesse's possessions found, specifically like his cell phone, his wallet, any of his clothes?
No. Mysteriously, none of those items were ever found. It almost seems like wherever Jesse went, those items went with him because they were on him. One challenge with Jesse's case was that the almost 1,200 other students who attended the mock UN conference who weren't from UMKC left Chicago the day the police were alerted of his vanishing. After they left, it became difficult to track everyone down who could be potential witnesses, which was essentially everyone. Jesse's parents attempted to speak with the other students, mainly the attendees from UMKC, and they claimed they were met with reluctance. Initially, they assumed this is because the students were traumatized by Jesse's disappearance, but then they wondered if there was something more going on. Did they know something they didn't want to share? Don and Donna said some students told them that UMKC discouraged them from speaking to them or the police. However, the director of media relations for UMKC denied this, saying, quote, "We provided Chicago police with a full list of students who were on the trip, and we have done everything we can to assist the family and the police in investigating and publicizing the case," end quote.
Was there anything specific that Don and Donna encountered that made them think this way?
I think it was just when they were trying to have conversations with these students, they felt that they were getting some pushback or some resistance. But the police have kind of echoed the statement from the UMKC director of media relations, kind of saying that they got full cooperation from everyone they spoke with. So I don't know what's going on here. I just wanted to present both sides. I think if the students felt reluctant to speak with anyone early on, it could be related to the fact that there was underage drinking going on that night. But overall, yeah. I couldn't find any evidence or information to support that any of the students were being looked at as suspects or persons of interest in Jesse's disappearance. And I know that more than 100 people were interviewed about Jesse's disappearance, and those who saw him shortly before he vanished were completely baffled by the entire incident, including his close friend, Ralph. In 2007, not quite a year after Jesse disappeared, his parents hired an experienced private investigator to look into the case. By then, the search for Jesse had long been suspended, and Jesse's parents were disappointed by the lack of progress from the Chicago police.
Was it just suspended because the police didn't have enough leads? They didn't have enough to work with?
I think they felt that they had searched enough in the water. And that was kind of the theory, according to Jesse's parents, that was kind of the theory the police were running with, was that Jesse entered the water and died the night he disappeared. And at a certain point, you run out of resources to continue that search. Although the police haven't confirmed that this is what they think happened, they have acknowledged that it's a possibility. But if this is what they believe, then searching in the river for him would be the most important thing to do.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Do a very thorough search of the river and find the body, if that's what your theory is.
Right. Jesse's parents were kind of like, okay, prove it if that's what it is. Right. Like, if that's what you think happened, then that's what you should be working on, is finding him. But they did search the river extensively, which makes it so perplexing that he could still be there and have been overlooked. So Jesse's parents felt that a private investigator could potentially dig up new information or come up with a new lead to follow. And from what I could find, they still work with this investigator today. And he has contributed a lot, but hasn't really come up with much. One lead he did look into was related to an alleged rave that was to take place in Chicago the night of Jesse's disappearance. Apparently, there was a flyer that circulated around the city about this rave, and Jesse mentioned it to some of the attendees of the conference, but no one was able to find a copy of this flyer, nor was there any evidence that Jesse actually intended to go to this rave. It seemed more like he mentioned this in passing, so this was a dead end. Jesse's parents have proposed the possibility that Jesse was handing out some of his mixed CDs. I told you early on in the episode about how Jesse would put together CDs and give them to people. And he brought some of these CDs on the trip to Chicago, and he even played them on the ride there. And at one point, he expressed to Derek, the chaperone, that he wanted to get his CDs out there because he was interested in becoming a DJ with an interest in DJing at raves one day. Jesse's parents wondered if he left the Sheraton Hotel on his way back to his hotel, if that's where he's going. He maybe approached someone with his CDs and things went awry from there. This is certainly a theory, but no one knows if Jesse had his CDs on his person that night or that morning, I should say, considering we're talking about 2:50 a.m. when he was last seen. In the last image captured of him on the security cameras from the hotel, it appears that there's something in the right pocket of his jacket. It's impossible to tell what is in his pocket, and I don't see how anyone would know what was in his pocket other than Jesse. So would he have brought the CDs with him that night? Who's to say? But they were not in his hotel room, so he either had them with him or he had already distributed them. It's possible Jesse realized he made it to the last night of the trip and he hadn't distributed many of his CDs, so he left the meeting room to do just that. But I also saw some information that indicated he was more interested in distributing the CDs to radio stations, not just random people in the middle of the night. That doesn't really seem like an ideal time to distribute CDs to radio stations. But I think part of the reason this concern came up was because Jesse was allegedly mugged in Chicago when he attended the Model UN conference the year before his disappearance. Jesse did not report the incident to the police, but he told his parents that he was mugged at knife point around 1 a.m. and his dad's camera, which he was borrowing, was stolen. Could he have been mugged again and it turned into an exceedingly violent event? In general, Jesse's parents worry that he could have been a little overconfident. Sometimes he was prone to poor judgment. And when you combine that with the fact that he was drinking, it puts him in a vulnerable position and someone could have taken advantage of this vulnerability. His parents learned that Jesse had about $400 on him the night he disappeared, a lot of $20 bills, and they were a little disappointed to learn this because they told Jesse to not carry a bunch of cash around. The streets of Chicago were pretty quiet that night, considering it was a Monday night or Tuesday morning on a cold day in November when Thanksgiving was approaching. So there were fewer people out who could have targeted him, but also fewer people who could have witnessed an incident involving Jesse. The possibility remains that Jesse was a victim of foul play that night. However, without a trace of him, there's no evidence to support that. There are quite a few factors that make this case so perplexing. One being that we don't know where Jesse was headed when he left the hotel the night he disappeared. If we had that information or footage of him heading a certain way, it could at least point investigators in a specific direction. Maybe he really just needed fresh air, like he indicated. But his family, as I stated, wondered if he wanted to pass out his CDs, or they've questioned if he was just headed back to the hotel he was staying at to call it a night. The emergency meeting was not over yet, but it's not as though it was mandatory. He could have left and there wouldn't have been consequences. Researching this case was interesting for a number of reasons, but as I said before, I thought I was pretty familiar with it, but I learned a lot. Especially the information about the exit he may have taken to leave the hotel that was not the exit on the south side, and all the information I shared about the Chicago River and the gate between the river and Lake Michigan. Many people think Jesse entered the Chicago River and drowned. The police have suggested this, but the police have also indicated that when people enter the river, they don't move much from where they enter. This is not supposition. This is based on their experience of recovering bodies from the water. So why would Jesse have traveled so far that he wouldn't have been found when the underwater searches began so soon after he vanished? I suppose one answer could be that he entered the water a great distance away from the hotel, so they started the search in the wrong area. But without cameras to show any of Jesse's movements after leaving the hotel, it's impossible to say. The biggest problem in this case is that any theory you can propose, there's no evidence to support it. There's no evidence that Jesse was harmed. There's no evidence that Jesse entered the water. no evidence that he died by suicide, and certainly no evidence that Jesse started a new life. And the theory that Jesse left to start a new life is the only one his family feels they can confidently rule out. Jesse had a lot going for him at the time of his disappearance, but the timing would be strange too. Late at night in Chicago after a night of drinking. Plus, I think now that it's been almost 18 years since Jesse disappeared and Jesse had an appearance that made him stand out, he'd have a hard time staying undetected for this long. But I also just don't think his parents believe they would do that to them.
I don't think Jesse entered the river just based on the fact that the Chicago police typically find bodies, 5 to 10 feet from where they think people entered the river.
Right.
And it doesn't seem likely that he would travel a far distance because they searched the river pretty thoroughly, very far from where his hotel was. So just based on those facts alone, I just have a hard time believing that he ended up falling in the river or getting pushed in the river or just entering the river at all. So I think it was something else. Obviously, I don't know what that could have been.
Right.
It could have been anything.
Yeah, I think I used to think, the most logical explanation was that he entered the river. But I don't really know that there is a most logical explanation in this case when you have no evidence. What do you even base that on, right? Every scenario is perplexing here. I guess people go that route because nothing of Jesse was found, not a sign of him. I think people think he probably would have been caught on camera at some point if he left the hotel. So I suppose that's why people kind of end up on the river theory. And I think in the Alexis Dillard case we covered, we definitely consider that as a strong theory because he entered that river before and we know that. But Jesse, I think this would have been an accident. I guess he could have been pushed. I have no reason to believe that. But if he did end up in the Chicago River, it was probably just a tragic accident. But yeah, that's what's so troubling about this case is that there's really no evidence to point in any one direction. There's reason to believe that if Jesse entered the Chicago River, he would have been found at this point. But we're also talking about a body of water. It's not foolproof that he couldn't still be there. Jesse's disappearance has impacted many people. Ralph said that he never listened to Jesse's segment on 95.7 The Vibe, and he always intended to. He always told Jesse he would, so that was something he felt regret about. Tragically, Ralph died in September 2010, just about 4 years after Jesse disappeared in a car accident. Ralph was loved by many, and the loss was extremely difficult. Derek went through severe depression after Jesse went missing, and he left UMKC after his contract ended. Then there's Jesse's family, who has had to adapt to life without Jesse by no choice of their own. At one point, Donna said something along the lines of, 1,200 kids attended this conference. 1,199 returned. Why did our son not get to return safely? I can't imagine how unfair that must feel. Jesse's family has gotten to know the families of other people who have disappeared. Early on, they sought advice and guidance from the other families. And as time has gone on, they have been able to help other families experiencing something similar. Jesse's parents are constantly reminded of his absence, and they have vowed to continue to search for Jesse until he is found. And Dawn has even written 2 books about Jesse since he vanished. Jesse would be 37 years old today. He is a white male with red hair, blue eyes, standing at 5'10", and weighing about 140 pounds. If you have information related to the disappearance of Jesse Ross, please contact the Chicago Police Department at 312-744-8266. We'd love to hear your thoughts in this case, so head on over to our Instagram, Key to the Case Podcast, or you can always email us at keytothecase@gmail.com. That is all for this case, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.